Welcome to Coach's Corner, brought to you by Front Rush. Hear from coaches across all divisions in sports talk about what winning means to them. Today we'll be talking to former MIT men's lacrosse head coach, Walter Alessi. Coach Alessi reflects on being a lifelong coach, the opportunity in coaching both lacrosse and soccer, and his most memorable moments at MIT. Thank you for listening to Coach's Corner.
Coach, you coached for a number of years, over 40 years, and I went through a brief snippet of your distinguished resume. You also served, you know, as we said, a lacrosse coach, a soccer coach. You did 20 years as an MIT day camp director, 10 years as an intramural coordinator. What's the secret? Diet, exercise, no sleep. What's the secret? That's a lot of energy, a lot of things going on.
I love what you do. I loved everything, and I loved all the people that I work with, the students, my cohorts. It was just a pleasure to go to work every day.
I think people as a whole are always striving for finding that vacation in their vocation, what they really like to do. And you know, once you find what you like to do, you never work a day in your life, so you'll sing. Yeah. You started this process in 1975. How quick did you realize this is what you wanted to do?
Well, you know, when I first applied for the job, I figured it would be a 1 or 2 year deal that I wouldn't really blend with an MIT type. I was a UMass grad from UMass Amherst grad, and I didn't picture the two meshing very well. But once I got on board and I started to know the student athletes at MIT, I just... They were just fantastic people, not only fantastic workers, but just people that I would want as my son, as my son-in-law, as my friend, just wonderful people. And I knew, I would say, within the first couple of years that it was a place that I thought I could be really happy.
So you're a young man, brand new into college coaching.
Yeah,
you get this assignment of a sport that's a little bit unknown to you. Where do you go from there? Do you go to the library? This is before the internet, so you can't just start Googling or going to YouTube and looking at soccer videos. Do you go to talk to people? What does that look like for you to prepare so that that first day of practice, the players at least believe you know what you're talking about?
Yeah, there was a great trickery. So before I took the position, I asked the AD to set up a meeting with the MIT soccer captains elect. I said I would like to speak to them, tell them the situation, and make sure that they're on board, because I didn't want to come in and have the captains opposed to me being there. So I assured them at the meeting, I told them the truth, that I didn't know much about it, anything about it, but I assured them that I would spend 50% of my time in soccer and 50% of my time in lacrosse. And so once that was settled, then I knew some friends. I had one good friend who was a football lacrosse guy who switched over to soccer, and I called him, and he set up so that I could go to, I believe it was 5 soccer camps in the summer of 1975. And really, I just was not teaching at the camp, just observing at the camp, drills, talking to the coaches, you know, because this was a high school camp mostly, or youth. Would this work at the college level? Can I do this at the college level? Can I do that? And then I met a lot of high school coaches who were very, very helpful in saying that you can do it. And my friend who had done it, he said, look at Walt, if I can do it, you can do it. And I said, well, I'll try it for a couple of years and see what happens. And so I had a lot of notes from those camps. And then I also went for a 1 week soccer academy. And that was just coaches. And it was instructional for not just new coaches, but for, you know, coaches who were trying to get increase their knowledge in soccer.
So when you first came to MIT, you were hired as a part-time lacrosse coach.
That first year, yes.
2 years later, you're also involved in the soccer program.
Yeah, but it was actually the very next year. So the spring of 1975 was part-time. I was still full-time employed at Westwood. Okay. And then in the spring, I would go over to MIT for lacrosse practices. And then during that spring, later that spring, I was offered the position of head soccer and head lacrosse coach for the 75-76 school year.
Very rare, especially in today's environment. And I have to imagine, even in the 70s, it was rare to have someone to coach two sports like that. In an area, you know, of a very pristine school at MIT. How did that come about? Did you seek that soccer position? Did they come to you and say, hey, we need you in both spots right now? What did that
Actually, I had never played or coached soccer prior to MIT.
Wow.
And so it was a came as my predecessor had been the lacrosse and hockey coach. And so when the athletic director came to me, I would say midway through the season, to talk about a position, that's what I thought he was going to do, was going to offer me hockey lacrosse, which I had played some hockey. I was familiar with hockey and had coached hockey at St. George's for a couple of years. But when he came and offered soccer lacrosse, I said, well, I think that leaves me out. And he somehow felt that I could do both, even though I hadn't played before. So it just was, I don't know, I can't, since he's deceased, I can't ask him now what he thought, but he obviously had some faith in me, and I had promised him that I would learn all I could about soccer, but, and I figured I would last soccer a year or two, and that would be it. And I just fell in love. Again, not with just the players, but with the sport. And I really enjoyed it and wound up doing it for 32 years.
After 32 years, somewhere in that 32 years, did you feel like from an X's and O's perspective, you know, kind of when did you feel comfortable? Where did you feel like, hey, I mean, you had some success. You guys made the tournament. You got to the eighth ranking in the nation. You won some awards for coach honors. So 2003, you were having success. I'm sure you felt more comfortable before that. But do you remember when that transition happened and what that looked like?
Well, it was, I would say it was gradual. You know, you felt a little better. Of course, don't think I was ever more nervous than the first day of practice in the fall of 1975. And I figured, well, if that's the worst it's going to be, everything's going to get better. And I had a knowledgeable assistant. I think that was a key, was to make sure you had assistants who knew what they were doing. And I didn't have to demonstrate much in soccer because I would either have the assistant demonstrate or I'd have the captains demonstrate. Mm. So that was helpful. And I just kept going to clinics, going to camps, going to academies. And, you know, you figure you're going to learn, you learn something every year, even in lacrosse, which I thought I knew some, you always can learn. And so I wouldn't put a time frame on it exactly, but I would say within the first 3 or 4 years, I felt pretty comfortable. Like I said, always increasing my knowledge year to year.
You mentioned you would spend 50% of the time on soccer, 50% of the time on lacrosse. Was there ever a time where it was a little confusing, like you started doing lacrosse things, working on the soccer side, or was there, you know?
There was a little bit, but mostly, you know, if something came up during the 50% that I was doing soccer and I had to do with lacrosse, I'd still do it and vice versa. It wasn't exact, you know, days, but I had told them, you know, from July 1 to December 31 to be concentrating on soccer, and then from January 1 to June 30th, I'd be concentrating on lacrosse. But it wasn't, and it never turned out to be exactly that, you know. But I can look in the mirror and say I was pretty close to 50-50 in terms of my input into each sport.
So before MIT, you really started your career at Rogers High School.
Yeah.
And another school called St. George's School.
Correct.
And actually, St. George now has an MVP award actually named in your honor. Is that correct?
That is correct. Amazing as it seems.
Oh, that's great. So, and you also taught and coached at a school called Westwood High School.
Correct. Now,
you were a teacher in this capacity as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
What subjects did you teach?
Physical education and health.
Okay. So when you first left school as an undergrad and decided out to go out into the workplace, what attracted you to go work in the secondary education market? Was it more the teaching or more the coaching or just a combination 50-50 of both?
I would say a combination. When I had done my student teaching, I realized I did not want middle school. And it came down to that, I mean, I really enjoyed the little ones, so elementary would have been good. But I thought that if I wanted to coach, that I'd like to be in the same building with the players that I'm coaching. So I thought that being an elementary school teacher and a high school coach wouldn't quite mesh as well as being a high school coach and a high school teacher. So I figured if something came up at the high school level, I would prefer that.
So I want to talk about coming out in the 70s as a teacher and coach, and then leaving the profession in 2017. What is different about that athlete, about that student in 1978 compared to 2018, right? What changes in that 40 years, if anything?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the truth, the MIT student athlete did really not change much. My relationship with them changed a little bit because, you know, when I first came in on, I was almost a peer, not quite a peer, but almost a peer. And then as I stayed, I became a father figure and grew into a grandfather figure.
Right.
But the students themselves have always been hardworking, honest. They didn't really let wins or losses affect them very much because school was always first. And whether we had a great win or a devastating loss, they still had to go home or back to school and turn in a problem set or prepare for a test or write a paper. So their perspective didn't really change. I mean, it's always been school first, but we'll give you everything I've got after that, but school's always first.
So you mentioned the MIT student profile, how that kid was such a good kid and such a good worker. And, you know, you wanted them as maybe even a family member. They represented a good son-in-law. It's interesting, as I talk to coaches, you know, the school first and the student athlete, it sounds like a lot of this was already kind of innately in them. Hey, I'm here for school first.
That's
was there
true.
Some times where you had to kind of push that too, coach?
No.
No.
The academics, if MIT did not have a men's soccer or a men's lacrosse program, I think the students would have still come to MIT because they were school first, and they knew that there was no future for them professionally in something like soccer or lacrosse. Mm-hmm. And so they were all in. They love coming to practice, but they were all in academically before I got there.
As I talk to coaches too, that are not at institutions that have as high of academic standards as an MIT does, one thing they struggle with is the pushing of the academics to make sure that their graduation rates stay up, that they keep kids eligible, that type of thing. You mentioned, the desire to be around the MIT kid. And so it leads me to think that because they had that academic drive, that transcended right into the person they were. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. I would. And it went into their drive to be as the best they could be in athletics, which might not have been a national champ, but, you know, they didn't come. I mean, if we could have won a national championship, I'm sure they wouldn't have minded. But that's not the reason they came. They came to compete at whatever level MIT was, which was Division III. And they, obviously came first to learn and to become a great student and set themselves up for a career.
MIT is obviously a very high requirement academic institution.
Yeah.
and very important what they're producing engineers wise and young men and women wise into our society and into the global society. Amazing, above and beyond sports. So when you're recruiting kids that are going to come in there, it's a little bit different challenge than if you're just at some community college down the street. There's obviously a small pool that you're already pulling from to begin with.
Yeah.
You're also might be recruiting now for two sports, soccer and lacrosse. Talk to me about some of the challenges that you had recruiting, some of the things that went well. What did that look like for you?
Yeah, it was certainly a challenge because the recruiting at MIT is significantly different than probably any place else in the country. The academic requirements are very high. There isn't much leeway from admissions in terms of, you know, what a admissible candidate looks like, you know. So the pool was already limited. So in recruiting, if a student was not in the, you know, mid to 700 range, mid 700 to 800 range on the math, it really was tough to, it was tough to consider that kid as a serious candidate. And then the same with their math and science SATs had to be very strong. Were there ever exceptions? You know, sometimes a kid might get in with like a 720 or a 730, but by and large, it was pretty high. But there were quite a few kids who had those scores and were pretty good players, but they just weren't quite enough of them to consistently have a highly competitive team. Because it's a tough combination having the kids who are like number one in their class or close to number one in the class with high scores and also be a superior athlete.
Mm-hmm. When you were recruiting for those sports and the academic requirements aside, was it more challenging to recruit for one of those sports than the other?
It was more challenging, I think, for lacrosse, especially in the early years, because there were many fewer lacrosse players in the 70s than there are now. But soccer, there was always a huge pool of soccer players. You know, there was just so many. Soccer was played all over the country. And so there, it took a lot of time because there would be a lot of soccer applicants, and you have to go through and find out which ones were academically, considerable. And lacrosse was many fewer candidates. It was much trickier doing it for lacrosse. It was harder to find good lacrosse players.
A lot of the coaches that I speak with talk about the X's and O's, the time with the young men or women that they coach with or that they coach over compared to the recruiting. Some people really enjoyed recruiting. Some people looked at recruiting as a necessary evil. Some people just absolutely despise recruiting. Where do you fit on that spectrum?
Well, I really didn't have to do very much what you would call typical recruiting. I mean, I didn't spend much time at camps because it was so frustrating. I did it in the first few years, but it's so frustrating to go to these camps, see all these great players, and very few who would be eligible for admission. So I didn't spend as much time recruiting as a normal coach would. So most of my time, much more of my time was spent on X's and O's and preparing the team than in recruiting.
In September of 2017, I was reading about the Department of Athletics at the MIT. They announced that they were going to establish the Walter Alesi Men's Lacrosse Head Coach Endowed Fund. That's a huge honor, and I know the endowment of those schools that do that. We've noticed that come about more and more these days, and I think that's a gigantic honor when someone sees that. What I thought was also really, really impressive about it was as I was reading about it, it said nearly 200 men's lacrosse alumni and friends that obviously you've touched their lives in some way contributed to the fundraising for this endowment. What did that mean to you?
It was just unbelievable. I was so moved. In usual situation, is that when there's an endowment done like that, it's named for the whoever gives the largest endowment. So it could be the, I don't know, or somebody's name, and it'll be, and that'll be the person who goes forward. But, you know, I didn't contribute a penny, and 200 or so guys gave enough money to have this. It was just very, very moving. I guess I could say I didn't realize, even though probably I may have should have realized, that I had this impact on so many people. It just was not a shock, but I was just very pleasantly surprised and tremendously honored that this happened in my name. And, you know, going forward to always have that as the go along with the head coach of men's lacrosse is very, very unique and extremely special. And like I said, I couldn't be more honored.
Reading about some of the quotes from some of the players I read, and this was in an article posted, again, September 2017, but you have guys that are now obviously, you know, adults and moved on with their families and their work and their business, and they played for you in 1980. And I hope I pronounced this gentleman's name correctly, Tom Faust.
Faust, yeah.
Said, for many team members, playing for Coach Alessi was one of the greatest joys of our college experience and one of the most enduring connections to the life of MIT. Meaning to me, obviously they got great joy. They learned from you, your leadership. But also, when they think of MIT, they think of you.
Yeah.
When you hear something like that, you had to spend a lot of time in field houses and a lot of time on fields and on buses and away from your wife and so does that kind of bring all that together for you? What are kind of some of the initial thoughts that you have in your mind when I reread?
I'll tell you, it brought tears to my eyes because there were so many people. I mean, at the retirement party, there were 300 or so players that came back, and you know, to see that many people and to talk to them and hear them tell me of the impact that a UMass guy could have on doctors, engineers, astronauts, senators. It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was overwhelming. That's probably the best. It was just overwhelming to hear that.
And
it made me very proud.
I think a lot of that, Coach, too, is, you know, I mentioned how you were doing intramural directing, you were running camps, you're doing, you know, coaching two sports, and you're a guy that just loves what you do, and you're caught up in the moment, and you're living in the present, and you're doing all those things, but, you know, when you sit back and reflect on it, that's when it kind of opens up your eyes. Wow, I affected this guy. He's a heart surgeon in Philadelphia. And, you know, I have a little bit of impact on what he does to his with his patients every day.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. And as a high school coach, you know, who I will not be able to get 43 years in for sure. But I'm hats off to you in that regard. I think that's amazing. And being able to touch all those young people's lives is definitely a gift. So,
well, like I said. You said it before. It felt like I never worked a day in my life. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. What are some tips that you thought were kind of the most effective for you in your coaching career? You mentioned you were prepared when you went into coaching the soccer. You had people do some of the demos for you. So you obviously used and delegated resources well. But what are some other things that you thought, you know, you were a very effective coach in multiple sports for a long time. What are some things to keep this legacy going? What are some things you could pass on to those of us that would love to learn from you more?
Well, I would say the number one thing, the players always come first. You know, their needs, they're all, you know, it's a team sport and they all have the same, but they're all individuals and they all have different needs. You know, not everybody responds to coaching the same way, whether, you know, sometimes you might yell at a kid, sometimes you might not so much yell, but you just be more instructional, and sometimes you might use a little sarcasm, just a little joke about something, but just treat them as individuals. Just treat everybody like you'd like to be treated yourself, and try to get to know each one as personally as you can. And treat them with respect, and remember that they always come first. Without them, there is no team. Again, you don't realize sometimes when you're in the moment the impact that you have on young men, but you do.
Yes, sir. And that's what's touching to me about your story. Why I think it's really important, because you have had the ability to touch so many different young lives, and have now matured into probably people that have grandkids of their own.
Yeah, some do. Some do.
And so, I think that that's an amazing thing we can do as humans with our legacy, and by touching others and serving others, which you're obviously doing.
Yeah, to that point,
memorable moments in 43 years, multiple sports, all the different roles you served at MIT. There's got to be a million of them. What just kind of come to the top of your mind as far as some memorable moments that you had in your career?
I've been asked that before. The number one moment was July 12th, 1969. That was what stuck out to me. That was the best day. That was our wedding day.
Okay.
But in terms of MIT, there's just so many. I mean, every day, it was just so much fun to be there every day. And we had some big wins and some devastating losses, but there was, no one thing that I can say sticks out that, it was just every day was a joyous day. And the players helped do that because, I'd be down. We'd have a tough one-goal loss. And, I'd come in the next day, my head might be hanging. And the next day, come on, coach, let's get going. We got another game coming up or whatever. They always was upbeat. And like I said, they weren't very affected by – I mean, they would, love the moment if we had a big win or a big upset. And they might be down a little bit if we lost the game. But by and large, they had athletics in the proper perspective, which I am not sure I did when I first came to MIT.
You're talking about respect of players, treating them all as individuals, making sure that they're important, that they're number one. It sounds like in that story, in that anecdote, they did kind of the same for you, propped you up when you needed it, picked you up when you were down.
Yeah.
That give and take is gigantic. And you were humble enough to have that kind of a democracy relationship with them almost. You're still in charge, but, there was a balance of power there compared to some coaches that say, it's my way or the highway. And so I think that's impressive. I don't know if coaches in the future are going that way or not, which leads me to my question of what do you see as the future of lacrosse and soccer in this country? Are you optimistic about it? Do you like where the sports are going?
Yeah, I just don't see, I wish it could, but I don't see either sport becoming a top four sport. I'm watching some World Cup going on, and every country in the world, soccer is so big, but I just don't see it taking over here over football, basketball, baseball, hockey. I just don't see it. But I think lacrosse has to be the fastest growing sport in the country right now at the youth level. I mean, it's just every state now has lacrosse. And when I first started, it was either upstate New York, it was Long Island, it was Maryland, and that was about it. Now it's everywhere. And soccer has been everywhere. And I still, with all the development and, here the U.S. team, pretty disappointing that it didn't make the World Cup this year. Soccer is still, it's a great sport, but I don't see it overtaking the big four. I just don't.
In terms of lacrosse, I grew up in Texas. They didn't have lacrosse as a child when I grew up in Texas.
Yep.
And we moved to California. I got into ice hockey. I played ice hockey and I played football. I don't know that much about lacrosse at all, except when I look at it, it looks like to me hockey on grass.
It is. It's very closely related to hockey in terms of the penalties and the play of the game. And it's also related to basketball because they do some, you know, they do picks, and they, some of the defenses and offenses are similar to what they run in basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But, and so I think that's another thing that I didn't mention before. When I was transitioning to soccer, almost all the team sports have connections to each other.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of similarities between the philosophies that are being used in soccer and the philosophies used in basketball and football and hockey. It's a lot of similarities.
In Texas now, lacrosse is making, you said it's the fastest growing sport in America, and I would support that.
Yeah.
I don't have any scientific proof for that or any data, but I see lacrosse a lot popping up at the high school level here in Texas. And I got to be honest, because I played ice hockey and then I played football, had lacrosse been offered when I was a kid, I think I would have definitely been drawn to it. So I think it is growing. I know it's taking away some of the kids that might play football.
Really?
Going to lacrosse.
Yeah.
They feel like it's a better choice for them. So we are seeing a big growth of that, which is interesting. Soccer's always been big in Texas.
Yeah.
But like I said, it definitely, we are seeing a surge of lacrosse down here. So interesting that we are seeing that countrywide.
It's everywhere. I mean, we've had players from Oregon, from we had twins who were freshmen at MIT this year from Las Vegas, who are both very good players. You know, we never had a player from Nevada before.
Sure.
We've had a kid from Idaho. You know, they're just everywhere. Montana. You know, we had places you would not traditionally think would have lacrosse. Florida, we have our all-time leading scorer at MIT as a Florida kid, which, again, Florida never used to have lacrosse.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You've been married for how many years, Coach?
Actually, tomorrow, 49.
Okay, 49 years. Congratulations, by the
Thank
way.
You.
That's a feat in itself.
She deserves a prize for that.
No, well, that's where I was going. you know, my wife has dealt with coaching in high school and not to the level that you coach by any means, but coaching football in Texas sometimes takes
Big
a lot
time.
Of time.
Yeah.
What, you know, talk to me about the importance of that relationship from a wife perspective and coach, especially for a man that's done it, been successful, and has had a wife that's probably had to put up with a lot as far as limited time and other things throughout those.
Certainly during the seasons, you know, she had to take a second fiddle at many times, but she always knew she was never second.
And that's in that subtle messaging to the spouse is very important for coaches, because obviously if they don't have something going on good at home, they can't be successful on the field or on the court.
I agree 100%.
So that's,
she was the rock.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I always knew that my kids, she did not work for the first 12 years that we had children, and she was a stay at home mom. And I always knew that she was doing what was best for our kids. And she was a great mom, and she was always number one.
Let's pretend that Massachusetts passed a state law that mandated that you must put a bumper sticker on the back of your vehicle and drive that every day, and that bumper sticker cannot come off. In other words, this is kind of your mantra, your motto, your saying. Coach, what does your bumper sticker say?
Oh, boy. Well, yeah, I have to tell you on this as an aside, my license plate is MIT-LAX.
Ah, I like it.
But if I had to say a motto, treat others like you'd like to be treated yourself.
The golden rule.
Golden rule. My parents taught me that. I think I've taught my kids that. And I've tried to live by that.
Well, I would say that you have done that very well. I think the evidence is compelling. The legacy that you've left around you, behind you, and in front of you is amazing, Coach. I could honestly talk to you for hours. very interested in your story and what you've done in all these people's lives. But I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk to me about this. Thank you
very
much.
Well, thanks for asking me.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, and good luck. Have a good season this fall.
Thank you, sir.